What's up, everybody? You're listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush, and normally I'd be joined by my fantastic co-host, Connor Cornelius, but he is out for this week, but that's okay. We've still got lots to talk about, plenty of cinema to dive into. We do have a fantastic guest today that we are so excited to be talking to. As you know, we like to talk to a lot of filmmakers and people who work in the film industry, but we also like to look at it from a different perspective. We like to get the critic's perspective. Now, they say everyone's a critic nowadays. I don't think that's necessarily true, because it takes a lot of hard work to be a critic. You got to watch a lot of movies, and you really got to have a gift of speaking about movies, which is a lot harder than it seems. Sure, we have a lot of opinions on things. We loved it, we hated it, and we throw it up on Twitter, but it takes a very special individual to put it into such fantastic language that can really delve into what a movie is all about and whether or not, at the end of the day, you want to see it. So today we are joined by Matt Cipolla. He is a writer and film critic, and he has written for Film Monthly. He's worked with Kino Lorber, and he recently went to the Cannes Film Festival as part of the 3 Days in Cannes program. Please welcome to the program, Matt. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start off with some really general stuff, because when it comes to criticism, like I said, everybody wants to be a critic. Everybody wants to have an opinion, but it's tough to get that correct formula of being a cultural commentator, but also giving legitimate recommendations to people that they might find useful. So what brought you to the profession of being a critic?
It was not something I planned at all, which is funny, because when I talk to other people, that's sort of the same gist I get from them as well. Just given the time I happened to grow up, I happened to get a Twitter when I was, like, shy of 13. I had thoughts on things. I would throw them up, but they wouldn't fit within 140 characters. So I moved to a Tumblr blog, and while I was still in high school, I started writing out reviews. And then I just kept doing that. And then it got to a point where I kind of had to, and it was sort of like an internal obligation that I just had to do it before I did anything else. And I just kept doing it. There was a professor I had at Columbia College Chicago last year who saw the consistency with which I wrote. And so she redirected me over to Film Monthly, and then I kept doing that. It all just sort of happened, really. It wasn't really until I was thoroughly, like, I was into it that I realized that it was, all along, it was my passion.
Well, that's an interesting way to realize your passion. You know, you just kind of start doing it for fun and to, like, be out of genuine interest, and then all of a sudden, when you're already a critic, you're like, oh, wait, I'm a critic now. This is what I do.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny, because I was talking to, I did a semester in L.A. I just finished up school, yay. Mm-hmm. And it was funny, I was doing a semester in L.A., and I was talking to Claudia Puig, who I took class with, and she was saying, there were some other people in the room, and she was talking, well, when was the time that you realized you had that aha moment of what you're doing is what you want to do? And I realized it was about 4 years ago. It was around the time when Under the Skin came out, and I saw it 8 times in its initial release.
Wow.
Just because I wanted to keep writing an analysis on it. I just wanted to dissect it from a thematic perspective, and then when I couldn't think of anything else that was thematic, I started to fall into the trap of putting movies together like a puzzle, which I don't really enjoy doing, but I just had to keep writing about something, and that was just all I wanted to do, really.
So what is it about film, and maybe we can relate it to Under the Skin specifically, since it had such an impact on you, was it about writing about film, cinema, whatever you want to call it, that really sparks your imagination and gets those, you know, editorial juices flowing in you?
Well, I mean, the way I always think about it is that cinema, just as an art form, is more of a 50-50 workload, and 50% is the filmmakers and then 50% of the audiences. And I think that might have to do with part of the reason that I gravitate more towards films with a heightened ambiguity, because they, generally speaking, they spark that interest more often in trusting the audience, for lack of a better phrase. And so when you have the first half of the equation, which is essentially just the filmmakers putting their work up on the screen. There's something sort of impressive and projective about an audience member seeing that and then projecting a combination of their own worldview, their upbringing, their philosophies onto that. And then it kind of makes, you know, criticism unto itself its own little art form. And I think it's really fascinating to just be able to read other people's analyses of other films, especially if they're just wildly varying, because you get a lot of insight as to those people in terms of who they are, what they've been through, etc.
That seems to be one of the central difficulties of criticism, is that you are when you're reading a critic, they are also, although they do have a forum or a platform to give their impressions or give their opinions on something, they are ultimately just the same as anyone else in terms of being an audience member who, as you said, bring their own projections to the film, bring their own psychology, their own experiences, and that's what shapes their opinion of the film. Do you try to lean into that idea of, this is my interpretation, this is how I see the film, you may see it differently, or do you try to go more general somewhere where it's like very recommendation, like you try to see it from other people's perspective?
Yeah, I mean, every once in a while when I'm writing a review, I might throw in something that's like, well, other people may see it elsewhere or from a different perspective, but that's sort of inherent to writing a review. I mean, film is inherently subjective, and I've never really enjoyed the idea of, oh, if you're a critic, you have to look at it entirely objectively, because I think that's cold and reductive, and it kind of discounts everything that you as a person bring to the film itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never really fallen into the trap of, when you write about a film, you have to basically just write about what they wanted. You also have to write about its larger, like its impact or its context within a larger scope, whether it's timelessness or its timeliness. But I think one of the major things that people have to realize is that there's such a difference between actually critiquing the movie that they made and critiquing the movie that you wanted them to make or expected them to make. Mm-hmm. And I think therein lies a crucial difference between a lot of writers. I mean, I was just talking to someone yesterday about Hereditary.
Right.
And they didn't like it. I loved it. But what I noticed throughout the conversation was a lot of it was, it could have been a lot scarier. And I was like, yeah, but it's a family drama. The writer director, Ari Aster, saw Cries and Whispers, Ordinary People. It's domestic drama in the guise of a horror film. It's not really a horror film. I would say it definitely is, but a lot of people are throwing that defense around. So when it's not balls to the wall, nutty, that's why it's holding back. And he's like, yeah, but I didn't want that. I'm like, okay, well, that's what you wanted.
And that's something that I think is really, Maybe it's just because of, my own age, and I don't know what criticism was really like, you know, maybe 30 years ago, apart from what I can read in old reviews in, like, you know, from the New York Times or, you know, some of the archives from Roger Ebert. But it seems very specific to now that people are very much wanting, you know, there's kind of an audience, I don't know if I want to call it revolution, but this idea that the audience is now the supreme author, in a sense. The filmmaker is there, but they are there to deliver a product. We've seen this a lot with the reactions to Star Wars The Last Jedi. As you mentioned, Hereditary as well, which had a very divisive sort of critic audience reaction result, where critics were lauding this as one of the scariest films ever made, or at least one of the scariest films made in the last like 10 to 15 years. But the audiences gave it a cinema score of about D+, which is pretty abysmal. You know, we're getting into Darren Aronofsky's Mother territory with that, which notoriously gained the cinema score of F. People hated it.
Yeah.
But critics generally, critics were even divided themselves, but it was a lot more favorable in the critics' eyes. Why do you think that the audience feels this sense of, I'll call it entitlement? They want the movie that's in their head. Why are we getting to this point?
Exactly it. I mean, because I think a lot of that is, especially within the last 20 years, we've reached such this exponential fast forward in terms of the amount of information that we can get within a 30-second span. And if you, and this sounds incredibly cynical and pretentious, but that's who I am. it's basically, there's this idea of, you know, if I can get, like every, all the information I can get within 30 seconds is all the information that there is. And so if it's completely out of left field, then it's just wrong. Or if it's not what I was expecting, then it's not what was intended. And then there are a lot of people who, like, you know, in a general and, like, very understandable sense, you know, you have a lot of casual moviegoers who aren't completely in tune to just the machine that churns out movies after they're in the can. And once you have something, I mean, I was talking to someone a couple weeks ago, and they were basically saying that, yeah, the Paramount people, when you were talking about Mother, they didn't see the movie until about 2 weeks before it came out. The trailer editors, there was someone around the pipeline, and so they weren't totally sure how to market it. They just sort of had an idea of how batshit it was. And so it's just a communication breakdown all around. That movie had a lot of confounding variables in terms of how audiences saw it. Mm-hmm. That's fun to talk about.
Yeah, and the marketing aspect of it, I've found that a little bit interesting, because there's, you know, a recent sort of disconnect with that audience expectation versus what the studio wants the movie to come off as. As you mentioned, Mother, maybe a little bit of Hereditary. One of the more egregious examples, I would say, was probably It Comes at Night, distributed by A24. I talked to a lot of people who said, well, that was a cool movie, but what was the monster? Was it a horror movie? Was it this weird sexual, you know, adolescence coming of age thing in the post-apocalypse? And the marketing really sold it as something almost akin to The Thing. You know, we thought we were going to see, a monster of some sort, something more typical. And I found it to be really interesting. You know, I found there to be a sort of salient point with the title It Comes at Night, but you never really see it. So what is it? And that gave me a guiding principle to watch this movie, or at least a lens through which to watch this movie. But so many people were disappointed because they wanted monster movie. What they got, something very different.
Yeah, I really like the movie as well. And I mean, that's also something that A24, whenever, every once in a blue moon where they do release something on day one in wide release, it does get that reaction. When there was The Witch, there was Free Fire, which came and went in like 2 weeks. There was... It Comes the Night, and there was Hereditary. All these movies were sold in a slightly off kilter to what they were relative to the film itself. Mm-hmm. And then people were like, hold up.
Yeah. I mean, even for me going into Free Fire, luckily, you know, being two, I would say the two of us are people that really keep up with like a movie prior to the marketing. Like we have a good idea of what it's actually going to be like, and then when we see the marketing, we already have the disconnect, whereas most people are going to get the disconnect later when they actually see the finished product.
If I do see marketing, it's mostly by happenstance. It's I don't go seeking out trailers,
right?
Unless it's something I saw at a festival and I'm like, ooh, how are they marketing this in retrospect, because I've already seen it, so I don't care. Or the idea of just going to a movie and they happen to play it. I'm like, okay, well, I saw the trailer, but I'm not going to, you know, rewatch trailers over and over.
Yeah. You're not refreshing Twitter to see if there's a, you know, finally a new trailer for, I don't know, the next Marvel movie. Like, it's really not that interesting. Like, you're going to take the movie at face value. You're going to see that movie and take it as its finished product, not what they're trying to sell it to you as.
Yeah, and I mean, on top of that, you have to look at trailer editing as its own art form unto itself. And there are trailers that I go back and I just watch the trailer because I think it's super well cut.
Yeah.
Like the trailer for Mother, the trailer for Thoroughbreds, whoever edited that trailer for Ocean's 8 is super talented.
Oh, for sure.
Like, entirely independent from the movie themselves, I'm like, these are just really nice 2.5-minute works of art that I like watching.
Yeah, the art of the trailer. I think there's maybe that's something you could get yourself into is trailer criticism. Let's break down the cinema of trailers. I really like that.
Yeah, it's so fascinating, though. There's this whole culture of, like, you go on YouTube and you'll see people do shot-by-shot analyses of trailers.
Oh, my God.
Like it's like a 22-minute video, and it's like borderline Rob Iger level dissection.
It's scary. I mean, you have these massive trailer reaction videos where it's either people that, I don't know, maybe it's a thirst for content, but like they take the Infinity War trailer, for example, and they're just like, okay, I think this is really hinting at what's going to happen to Captain America. And this is actually obviously a reference to, and then you have like fanboys and fan people, let's say, and they're watching these trailers and it's just 20 minutes of them crying.
Yeah.
It's a very strange world. I want to ask you about the effect of digital media and this kind of, and social media at large on criticism. We've seen its effects on, you know, regular news and things like that. The way that news gets distilled through the lens of social media. And I've noticed a little bit of a similar trend in criticism. I think those forums such as Rotten Tomatoes or Metacritic, things like that, have given this weird kind of magnifying glass that takes big ideas and pushes them through a prism to something more digestible for the audience, more or less amounting to it was good or it was terrible. And yep. I was curious to get your thoughts on whether or not we can still have nuance or more of a discussion when we have these kind of shorthands for evaluating a movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I remember the first time I heard about Rotten Tomatoes, and it was about 9 years ago, because my dad told me about how great its score was, or like the score for Up was on Rotten Tomatoes, and I was like, what the hell is this? And then I just sort of got attuned to it, and it's something I check regularly, and then I sort of fell out of it within the last 2 years or so. It's a fascinating idea by theory, and I do check it often to see where did it fall. But the idea of, I mean, the whole binary concept of fresh rotten is pretty problematic, and I mean, the main thing is, I don't think it's necessarily their fault. It's just a lot of ways that people have come to perceive it and how they assume what the percentage means. I mean, because, you know, every single person gives something a 7 out of 10. That's 100%. It's just percent of positive reviews.
Right.
And so that's one of the reasons I also sometimes look at Metacritic. They actually will weigh something out of 100.
Mm-hmm.
Although one thing I don't like that Metacritic does is that they weight the impact of certain critics' scores. So they sort of, they give seniority to certain critics and they'll have more of an impact on the overall meter. But I don't know. I've kind of also turned away from the more traditional aggregate scores, and I like looking at user scores on things like Letterboxd.
Yeah, Letterboxd is a really interesting platform that I've only discovered fairly recently, and I mean it's akin to something like a, you know, say Goodreads, which is a pretty popular app for books, or maybe like Rate Your Music when it comes to music. But I find the community on Letterboxd to be really fascinating. It seems to be an overall positive place. Obviously, with anything on the internet, there's going to be a small but vocal group of people that are just going to, I don't know, make things crappy for everyone else. But I really seem to find a lot of merit in this website as a forum. So tell me a little bit about how you use Letterboxd.
Yeah, I take Letterboxd far too seriously. I found out about it a little over 3 years ago, and I retroactively, I started saving all of my ticket stubs on January 1st, 2010, so I have all those in my possession. So I retroactively logged all of the movies since then. Whenever I see something in a theater, only in a theater, I will log it onto my diary. I'll rank a yearly, like, all the releases from a given year, from best to worst, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'll plug my reviews with like a blurb and then a link to it. But I just think it's fascinating to look at how different people use it, mostly in terms of there are people who will write full-on actual reviews, which I really enjoy. And then there are also people who will just write kind of like snappy one-liners, which I also enjoy because they're funny.
Right.
And it's like no one's obliged to write an entire review on a social networking site. It's not that serious. And then sometimes you'll get people who just sort of shit post, and you're like, well, it's the internet.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I do think it really highlights this sort of, you know, that film bubble it's sort of, in a good way and a bad way, it's like film Twitter, but under a microscope, warts and all. But I do definitely enjoy it. It's something that's more restricted in terms of, you know, I don't come across more people that I don't know who they are, because it's not like Twitter where it shows you what tweets are popular at the time when you open the app, you know, mm-hmm. stuff like that. But I think it's a really interesting tool, and I use it a lot.
Yeah, especially being a critic, it can definitely be a way to get your reviews out there. As you mentioned, you know, you put a piece of the review and then plug the rest of it, giving people a chance to find the rest of the writing. And it seems to me that people on Letterboxd do have an appreciation for, and obviously I'm generalizing a little bit, but they do just seem to have an appreciation for film as a big discussion piece, and things, it's very amorphous and people can really argue and discuss, but it doesn't come off as too hateful most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, you'll get that. That's just say a lot of you, but I mean, for the most part, there is something to be said about, I think that a lot of the, like when I think about it, the two largest and most common accounts that I come across, one of them is just a girl named Lucy. I think her name is just Lucy, and she posts just like snappy one-liners, and I like her because she's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is David Ehrlich, and they're basically just emblematic of those two schools of thought, which is, I'm going to have fun with this, or like, I'm going to post a whole thing and link to it from an analytical perspective. And both those are totally valid. Like, again, it's a social media platform. This is not the Chicago Tribune.
Right. Right. I want to jump into your time at the Cannes Film Festival, one of the biggest film festivals in the whole world, super well respected, a lot of great stuff. And you got a chance to go through this program or this thing called 3 Days in Cannes. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I saw a tweet from Eric Cohn from IndieWire, and he tweeted this thing, this initiative, and it's the first time they've ever done it. It's just called 3 Days in Cannes or Cannes. And it was essentially a thing for anyone 18 to 28, they could apply. So I wrote a cover letter. I sent it in. You had to send a scan of your passport or some sort of legal documentation to prove that you can actually go.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sent that in, and then I woke up the next morning about 18 hours later, and I got an acceptance letter and started crying. So that was fun. It was really good timing. I shipped myself off a day after graduation. It was for the last 3 days of the festival. I was in the town proper for about 5 days, but the program covered the last 3 days of the festival.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to see 10 different movies in 3 days. A lot of reviewing, a lot of writing drafts on my phone, while waiting in line for other movies.
The true critic experience.
A lot of not really eating full meals, but just having a banana and a shot of espresso in between movies. It was great. It's a lot. The first day was sort of a shit show because I'm like, I don't speak French, and I feel completely out of water here. But I mean, after a while, you sort of lose all integrity and just go for it.
Tell us about what, describe to us. I mean, I've never been to the film festival. Many people never will go to the film festival. So describe what the energy is like there.
Yeah, so every morning, well, the 3 mornings that I went, I got up at like 7:30. The earliest movie I went to every day was at, I think, 8:45 in the morning. essentially there's the Pelé, which is, if I'm not mistaken, 7 or 8 screens exist, and that's what they'll show their films on. Mm-hmm. There's the Grand Lumière, which is the flagship theater, which everyone, when they have a gala screening in the evening, everyone's in, you know, tuxedos, women have to wear heels. It's kind of weird. You'll have to get an invitation for those showings. If you can't, there are sometimes people that you'll see just sort of standing around with cardboard signs that have, they're basically saying, like, if you have a ticket, please give it to me for this movie. There's always a guy running up and down the line trying to sell you newspapers. There's a lot going on. There's a constant swarm of beeping because they scan everyone's badges whenever they basically go anywhere. It's a lot. It's super fun, though, especially in the event that you do get to sort of watch any sort of like a premiere of a film. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to see Copper Now. That was a movie that was surprisingly polarizing. But that was a movie where I got to see everyone just sort of like do their thing on the red carpet. I got like 100 feet away from Cate Blanchett, so that's
wow. Yeah, you putting that in the memoir.
Yeah, totally.
So what were some of the films that you got to see over at the film festival, over at Cannes?
Okay, so I saw a movie called Dog Man, which is pretty good. It's from the director of Tale of Tales, which I thought was okay. Mm-hmm. I saw Whitney, the Whitney Houston documentary, which is okay. That comes out in Chicago this coming Friday from when we're recording it. So July 7th, I believe, mm-hmm. July 6th or 7th. This queer slasher called Knife and Heart, which I wanted to like a lot more. It was like this pastiche of Argento and Refn and Cinema Paradiso. So it's a lot of stuff. It doesn't really work. But it had a knife shaped like a dildo that people were murdered with, so that was cool.
you don't see that in a lot of movies?
Yeah, no, it's so European. I saw Into the Silver Lake, which is pretty good. It was fun because I was thinking, do I want to see this? Because it comes out in a month.
Yeah.
And then A24 delayed it by 6 months. And I was like, thank God I saw that.
Yeah, good thing you got that one in.
I'm curious to see, there have been like flutterings of, are they going to recut it? Because the movie is 2 hours and 20 minutes. And
oh, wow.
It's pretty out there at times. Like, there's a lot of David Lynch. There's a lot of Michael Powell. There's sort of like a, everything is intentionally archetypal. Like, the protagonist played by Andrew Garfield is meant to be little more than the archetype that Hollywood markets to, and that he's a straight white male who's pretty entitled.
Okay.
It doesn't, when it works, it's great. It doesn't always work. I liked it overall. I'm curious to see what they're going to do with it, assuming they do something else with it in the next coming months. I hope they don't mess it up.
Yeah. And that's from the director of It Follows. Is that correct?
Yeah. David Robert Mitchell.
Interesting.
It Follows is also at Cannes.
Very cool. Yeah, because I liked It Follows, and I think It Follows definitely kicked off a lot of think pieces, or at least a lot of ideas about, is this the new wave of horror? Is this what we're going to do now? So it's interesting to see him continuing, although this is not particularly horror, right? It's kind of like a mystery sort of thing.
Yeah, it's like a wacky, it has like touches of noir, like neo-noir. Mm-hmm. It has touches of, it reminded me a lot, without spoiling anything, there are some aspects of it that reminded me of stuff you'd see from Michael Powell, and just sort of this absurdist, you know, nudge, out, like, gleefully out there humor. Mm-hmm. It's winding Paul Thomas Anderson, Thomas Pynchon sort of nuttiness.
Okay, I like that. Is it any resemblance to something like, oh goodness, I can't even remember the title of that P.T. Anderson, Inherent Vice? Is it something akin to that?
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, the character is pretty much always stone, so yeah. I didn't necessarily like Inherent Vice. I thought it was okay. I like this more. But I could definitely see that, especially with the sort of just way
Okay, I see that. And do you have any plans to get back into Cannes? Is there any chance that you're going to get to go next year?
Oh God, I hope so. I wish. I would love to be able to do this again. It was super fun. Part of it was just the sheer energy of it. Part of it was just the glamour. And also being able to see movies, not knowing anything about them, that's super rare. Even if it's something like I saw the new Jean-Luc Godard, I was like, what's this going to be like? And it was fun to see people fuck out of that. It was like, you know, there's just such an infectiousness to everything. Black Klansman played like gangbusters.
And that's the new Spike Lee.
Yeah, super, super fun.
Very exciting. Very, very exciting. Yeah. I mean, there were so many films that, you know, you make a dream list of the year. It's like, oh man, I really wish I could see this before everyone else. So I'm glad that you got a chance to go over there, see some of these movies before the rest of the public sees them. I wanted to hop over to your Letterboxd, in fact, and take a look at a little bit of some of your favorite movies of 2018 so far. A lot of these are also, I'm looking at the list right now, and a lot of these are also on my list. How do you think 2018 has been as a film year so far?
Surprisingly audacious. I am very happy with what I've seen so far. I mean, especially if you compare it to something like at this point, there's definitely been more movies that I've loved. If you look at this, like right now, it's June 30th as we record this. We are at the halfway point. If you were to take this halfway point and place it into the context of 2017 or especially 2016, at this point, we didn't have nearly as many great movies as we have now. I'm impressed. I hope it keeps up.
Yeah, it's such a weird dichotomy because on one hand, we've seen, I feel like, a lot of really interesting and, as you said, audacious, kind of art house, I guess, to put a label on it, indie, whatever. Seen a lot of smaller movies that have really impressed a lot of people, even on a larger scale, like something like Hereditary, which performs so well compared to what I would have ever expected for an A24 movie with such a wide release. But meanwhile, we're seeing some of the biggest franchises just totally steamroll the box office. I mean, with the release of stuff like Black Panther and Avengers, and even more recently Jurassic World. I read in Deadline that the North American box office, in fact, reached $6 billion faster than it ever had before.
Yeah.
So I it's this strange kind of split where it's just like there's a lot of movies I see that are bigger and I'm just like, oh God, I hate this. Like, I hated Jurassic World 2. I couldn't stand it. I walked out with about 20 minutes left. I was like, oh, I'm not going to do this anymore. But in the meantime, we get things like your number one on this list, Eighth Grade, from the kind of, I guess, millennial comedian Bo Burnham, which I got the opportunity to see that at the Chicago Critics Film Festival, and I was in love. I was so in love with this movie. Well, there you go. It's I put myself right in the front row because I had to be there for the Q&A. I find Bo Burnham to be a really interesting figure. But tell me your thoughts on this movie, because it was for me something so surprisingly honest and I don't know, just emotionally affecting. I can't wait to see it again so I can try to watch it through a different lens from just that first raw viewing. But give me some of your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, part of it has to do with the fact that it's just so refreshing to portray early adolescence as the total shit show that it is. Just throughout, there's such a deep empathy for our protagonist, Kayla, and what I love about it is that empathy comes through just the cringiest of cringe humor. My face was contorting. it manages to strike this really fine balance between being emotionally intimate in the moment and thinking that, okay, this is, like, as you're living these moments, you're like, okay, this is just the world, this is life, and also all the while portraying it with just enough dissonance that you're able to look at it from like a retrospective perspective, but perspective as an adult, and sort of laugh with her struggle, but it's never cruel. I mean, it's not, I love Welcome to the Dollhouse. It's not Welcome to the Dollhouse. It's
right.
Not par excellence in that, you know, cruelty is empathy, but there's definitely such a, there's such consistency to it. There's a timelessness to it and just all the struggles. There's something very current about how they touch on things like social media and YouTube and Snapchat, but they never overdo it. And if they do overdo it, it's intentionally so. It's just, you know, adults and teachers trying their best to connect with children, and it's just not working. And I also think it's, especially for a directorial debut, there's a surprisingly strong grasp on cinema as a language. You know, it moves really well. It's very well edited. A lot of use of superimpositions. There's sort of a brisk dreaminess to everything that exists within the digital hemisphere and how that bleeds over into her actual world. And just all the while, it's just hilarious and cringy and sweet. And I cried just writing my review.
Oh, well, it is one of those movies. You do really connect with the main character so much, even though it might be so outside of your experience. And in that Q&A that we saw, Bo even touched on that. He's like, he grew up in a totally different time. Not, you know, he grew up identifies as a man, and just has no real, like, you know, personal context for specifics about Kayla's experience in this movie, specifically relating to a lot of technology aspects. But what I think he picked up on, and I think a lot of people also picked up on, was his ability to find the timeless moments of that, the timeless emotions that can transcend those, you know, details of being social media and technology obsessed and being an eighth grader in 2018. I think that's really the biggest credit of the film, is being able to transcend all those sorts of things to give you something that you can really think about for a long time and definitely watch again. I am very, very excited to see it again.
Yeah, it comes out, I believe it hit Chicago July 20th. I believe that's what it's slated for.
Another one I want to touch on is your number three pick, Annihilation, which was a movie that... It was, you know, I was excited for it, very excited for it. Big fan of Ex Machina, directed by Alex Garland, written as well by Alex Garland, and based on a book that I think I made a big mistake, and I read the book right before I watched the movie. The book is maybe 200, 250 pages, totally blow through it, and I read it on a plane, and then I got off the plane, and then I watched Annihilation, and... I was impressed by a lot of the facets of it. I thought there were great performances. I thought visually it was very cool and it felt very original. But I really the movie almost completely lost me once it got to the very end.
Totally won me over.
I don't want to, I'll throw out a spoiler alert here. If you have not seen Annihilation, go check it out for yourself, because really it's fantastic that this movie got made. And, I was satisfied with most of it, but when it gets to the end where they're like in the hospital and they have Natalie Portman's character and they do the little iris kind of reveal where it's like, oh, it's not actually her. I just felt like that was so predictable. I was like, no, this is not the ending I want. I mean, maybe this is a little bit of my entitlement coming from reading the book, but I was like, oh, I really had that stuck in my craw, because the rest of the movie felt so unexpected and so strange. And then you get to that and I'm like, oh, this feels kind of cliche in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I didn't see it that way, because I felt like a lot of it was about the chaos of the universe.
Right.
And that fed into the unpredictability of it for so much of it, especially in the last 20 minutes or so. It just becomes like an art piece.
Yeah.
But when you do finally get that release of knowing who she is at the end of her journey, it was sort of like, it sort of, you know, punctuates the entire film with something that's a little more... tangible,
Yes.
And it sort of, I felt it acted complementary to everything that preceded it.
Well, I can
actually, like, it was oddly hopeful. It was oddly hopeful in a weird sort of way, even though she, for all intents and purposes, Lena as a character, she didn't make it out of there as she went into the Shimmer. But there's a sense of closure that, you know, she was looking for all the while.
Yeah, and I'd say largely, I enjoyed the movie a lot. Definitely recommend it. If only for that horrifying scene with the bear creature, I was gripping the sides of my seat. I was like, this is possibly the best 10 minutes of 2018 so far. I was like, this is unbelievably good filmmaking, and I really, really loved a lot of those elements of it. Can't wait to see what Alex Garland comes up with next, because I think he's been doing film for a long time, mostly in a writing capacity. Very famous for writing 28 Days Later, which I think was what saved the zombie movie genre from itself and brought a lot of new life into it. So I'm very happy that he has still got some skin in the game. I want to point out I think reading this, your review of this again, had me laughing so hard, because you just really communicated your distaste for this movie. Very bottom of the list for 2018 is Gotti, starring John Travolta, and I can't believe how much your writing communicated the disjointed nature of this movie and just how sloppy and just unbelievably boring this movie was. Tell me a little bit about your experience watching Gotti.
This movie is a shit show. I called it the Geely of gangster movies, because it's what I felt like I was watching. It was just totally incoherent. I think it's sort of fascinating to look at from a production standpoint, in that this was in the pipeline for 7.5 years. They cycled through stars and directors. Joe Pesci, I believe, was supposed to be in it, but then he got dropped, even though he gained a lot of weight for a role, and so he sued them and got really pissed. I think it was settled out of court. It was just a shit show, and John Travolta was saying that this was his passion project and that he was going to make it no matter what, and I'm just like, oh, come on. You've got to be able to do something else with your time. Are you seriously? It's just, I mean, it covers the late 70s to the late aughts with no real rhyme or reason in terms of how the pacing plays out. It's so arrhythmic that I'm surprised it didn't just die of heart palpitations on the spot. The makeup is really inconsistent. Everyone, it's inconsistent, but it's also startlingly and distractingly consistent, and then everyone looks the same age despite having lived over a quarter century of just bullshit. there are multiple original songs written for the movie by the one and only Mr. Worldwide, Pitbull.
That just saves the movie, doesn't it? Thank God that we got Mr. 305.
Yeah, and it's amazing. I mean, there's even one scene where they play, they don't really have a lot of diegetic music in the movie. There is one scene, though, where they're all having like a 4th of July party in an alleyway, and they're listening to Don't Stop the Party by Pitbull, and it's within the realm of the film itself. It's not overlaid.
Right.
It's mixed as if they're listening to it, but it's the only time they use anachronistic music within the universe of the film. And so there are just little touches like that where I'm like, where are you going for? Like, all the pickup shots are clearly just stock footage, and they're really grainy.
So it's just avoid at all costs.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, if you're curious to see just the trash fire, I guess it'll tickle your fancy, but I don't think it's bad enough to be good. It's just, like, it's more fascinating to read about. I mean, if anything, like, you'll laugh when you hear the score, because it sounds like a temp track. It's like someone had like a MIDI keyboard in 1995 and they were like doing like a fan, you know, rescore of like Donkey Kong Country 3 or something.
Oh my god, that is truly, I can hear it in my head right now, just overlaid with a very angry and tense looking John Travolta.
Yeah, if you want to hear him say, "I will park a bus up your ass sideways," this is a movie for you.
Oh, wow. Well, now I think I have to see it out of genuine curiosity. Really, that just sounds like a lot of fun.
It's like, yeah, it's a unmegged disaster, but I don't know if I can be mad about it. It's like, who cares? Who cares?
And you mentioned in your review, this is directed, isn't it directed by Turtle from Entourage?
No, Eric.
Eric, okay.
Kevin Connolly directed this. This is not his debut, apparently. He's apparently directed some other stuff.
Wow. Well, there you go. Worst film of the year so far from Matt Cipolla is the... it's Gotti. It's gotta be Gotti. The worst one of the year so far. But I'm sure, you know, we've got 6 months left. Let's see what happens. Let's see where it goes.
Yeah, let's hope for something worse.
Before we go, I just wanted to pull one of my favorite... I want to give people an example of your writing, because it is truly some of my favorite to read when it comes to critics. You know, there's so many critics out there that you can't... I mean, you can't read them all, but there's some that you just latch onto. And I think for you, it's the way that you write about these movies is just so relatable. And but just remarkably intelligent. This one's coming from Deadpool 2, which you can read this review on filmmonthly.com. It's written on May 25th, 2018. And I have to say, this totally summed up how I felt about Deadpool 2 as well. Because as many people know who listen to the show, I work in a movie theater, and we get together and watch the movies usually the day before they come out to make sure the projection is correct. And watching it, everybody else was having a better time than I was, and I was just so upset with everything I was seeing. And I think I'll read a little bit here from Matt that sums up why I was so upset. "There are several ways in which a boy can become a man. Shaving for the first time, finishing high school, deciding not to shave, graduating from college, or realizing the limitations of wall-to-wall irony are all possible candidates for such a checkpoint. But for me, it was a month ago when I rewatched Deadpool. I loved it when it came out. I found it to be the freshest and most entertaining comic book movie since 2010's Kick-Ass. However, I was also a 19-year-old college sophomore when Deadpool came out. Looking back with my infinite wisdom as a 21-year-old college graduate, the first film was okay at best. Its junky quality was a blessing and a curse. And while it was hypocritical from a parodical standpoint, it also had a certain charm to it. It was smaller, and its comparably meager $58 million budget forced screenwriters Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick to fiddle with structure to create the illusion that it completed more than it actually did. But almost double a tepid achievement's budget are the incentives for its makers to really try." That paragraph just really got to me. And then calling Deadpool 2 119 minutes of total fluff. That was just so true. And the wall-to-wall irony thing really hit it home for me, why I don't really seem to like Deadpool at all as a character. Tell me a little bit about writing this review. And I mean, I like that you look back and say, my tastes have changed. These things don't really work for me. The audience has grown up.
Yeah, it's especially frustrating because it's something in theory I should love. I have such a soft spot for meta humor, mm-hmm. just in any way, shape, or form. So I guess it also kind of irks me to an even higher degree when it's used as a crutch to just sort of void all criticism and say, like, well, yeah, it's not original, but, like, you know, it's not like we think we're doing anything good.
Yeah.
But we're doing something. but, I mean, as I sat there, it was fine. Most of the thing was that I was bored, and there reaches a point where, you know, it's just a gleeful sense of abandon just turns into just total abandonment. Mm-hmm. And I think it really does. I mean, you can't not compare the Deadpool movies to Kick-Ass, at least the first Kick-Ass.
Right.
Let's not talk about the second Kick-Ass. But it just, it could have done a lot more, and it just didn't. And I don't think that they were necessarily trying. I feel like there's a sense of complacency in that everyone involved already proved themselves. I mean, Ryan Reynolds basically flexed his muscles to fire the first movie's director, Tim Miller, because he wanted it to stay more comedic, whereas Tim Miller wanted there to be more action. Mm-hmm. And so you can tell that Ryan Reynolds probably got pretty cocky about it. He's like, see, it succeeded. I know what I'm doing. I can just keep doing it and
yeah.
not really change anything. And I was like, yeah, it's kind of showing in the final product.
Yeah, and that's the thing I find a little bit ironic is that Ryan Reynolds, you know, wanted to the comedy to stay so he could still be that winking, fourth wall breaking, you know, hero. But then they hire David Leitch, who is one of the directors of John Wick, which for me was one of the biggest breaths of fresh air into the action genre that I'd ever seen. It made me want to go back and get into action movies again. And then they come out with Deadpool 2, and watching these sequences, I was like, oh my God, these are so poorly directed, so poorly shot, so poorly choreographed. Why even hire this guy? And he recently did Atomic Blonde as well, which I didn't love, but the action sequences were totally on point, and that kept me interested in the film. This, I was like, great, I have 15-year-old humor and really crappy action sequences set to Dolly Parton. What do I do with that?
Yeah, I mean, it was also just, it was especially bizarre because a lot of it, the scenes were, like, you could tell that they were choreographed and staged decently, but the way that they were actually shot and edited, all the cross-cutting and reverse angles were really disorienting. I couldn't really tell what was happening, and it was especially troublesome because you can tell that those on set, they know what they're doing, and they're probably doing a great job, but I can't tell.
Yeah, no, there'd be no way to tell. Maybe it was just a total hatchet job in the editing room that really tone down those action sequences to be, you know, and Bourne-esque, you know, when we talk about that kind of shaky cam sort of thing. Just so much, as you said, so much cutting, so much not letting the audience see what's happening and really enjoy it. The way I put it to people was, you know, they lost sight of what makes a good action scene. They should go watch some more, you know, Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee knew how to do an action scene. He lets you see what was going on. And instead of that, they opted for the easy way out, which made you think there was a lot going on. But when you pay attention, you're totally lost in all the noise.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Matt Cipolla, for coming on No Coast Cinema and talking a little bit of criticism and talking about Khan, all the good stuff. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You can find him on Twitter. It's at Cipolla Matt. That's C-I-P-O-L-L-A Matt. And you can read all of his reviews over at Film Monthly. And he's also on Letterboxd. If you use Letterboxd, go ahead and follow him. He's got some great lists, got some great reviews that you can read over there as well. Again, thank you so much, Matt, and you know, we'll see you at the movies.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, this has been No Coast Cinema here on WGM Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush, and we will see you all next week.